This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, Trek FM's dedicated Star Trek books and comics podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and joining me is the wonderful Bruce Gibson. Bruce, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad to be here, because I want to talk about Star Trek books and comics with you, Dan.
Excellent.
And you know what? There's an empty seat, and it's making me sad that Matt's not here anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Longtime listeners will definitely notice there is a missing voice. And of course, Matthew Rushing is no longer a regular on the show, but he will be joining us from time to time in the future. So have no fear. If you miss the dulcet tones of Mr. Rushing, you will be able to hear those again soon.
I can't wait for him to sing one more time for us.
We're going to be begging for it by the time he's back.
And Dan, I'm expecting you to sing at some point too.
It's been known to happen, but very rarely. So, yeah. Well, on that note, see what I did there? We've got a few news topics this week to take a look at. A couple new comic books have just been released. First was released just before the new year, and it's the first issue of the second series of Green Lantern comics. And this series is called Stranger Worlds Number One. Bruce, what did you think of this one?
Well, here's the thing. I still haven't read the first series of Star Trek and Green Lantern crossovers. And I was thinking of doing it before I read this, and then I saw that it's coming out as a trade paperback in April. And I thought, I'd really like the trade paperback, but I kind of want to read it now. And then it dawned on me, you know what? I know, Dan, that you read the first series of these Green Lantern crossovers, the first six issues of the series, and I thought from your perspective, you can relate these issues to that, and then I can come in and see if this holds up without reading those issues.
That's, yeah, and I mean, the one thing this comic does also do is provide a pretty good quick little recap of the events of that first series, very briefly, but, you know, not too bad. The one thing I am relying on you for this one, though, too, is familiarity with Green Lantern. Because the entirety of that I know about anything to do with Green Lantern all comes from that first Star Trek crossover series. So I know nothing about him, really.
So you hadn't even seen the movie that came out a few years ago?
No, actually, I didn't. It was always on my list. And then I read some reviews and heard some friends' opinions and then never saw it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a big Green Lantern historian. And just to let you know my extent of Green Lantern, I was always a huge Superman fan. So I collected a lot of Superman comic books, including Justice League. And of course, I got to know Green Lantern a lot through the Justice League, but I never really bought his own title. So I don't have a deep knowledge of Green Lantern. I have more of a Justice League Green Lantern familiarity, but I am somewhat familiar to keep up with who some of these characters are.
Oh, okay. Right on. Well, yeah, as far as this issue goes, it's kind of one of those things that, to me anyway, you know, there's not a whole lot to talk about. It's kind of reintroducing the idea again and kind of setting the stage for where all of these characters are in the universe, and setting some interesting things up. It seems that the lanterns who are in, I don't know what they're
the
called.
The Green Lanterns, I don't remember. Now.
Core. That's the word core. I was looking for. Those guys. Apparently their rings are all kind of weakening and cutting out at very inopportune moments, such as demonstrations in front of a group of eager cadets and during big battles. So some interesting things going on there. We're not sure why that is. Possibly they think it might be because they need to be recharged. Again, lack of familiarity on.
Well, yeah. So what they do is they have these lanterns, hence Green Lanterns. So they have these lanterns that they put their rings into to recharge them after a while. Just like you're going to take your mobile phone and charge it, you know, overnight or whatever, they have to charge their rings. So they don't have their lanterns with them when they moved from one universe to the Star Trek universe.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. And that tells me where the lantern part comes in, because I kind of wondered that. Cool.
Yes, it's not just about the emblem on their shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. So that's why, which I really liked. And like you said, there's a bit of a summary to set up what happened in the previous issues, like I said, that I didn't read in the first miniseries. So knowing that the lanterns, now I'm calling them the lanterns, but the core, well, the universe they're from was being destroyed. And then so they were brought into the Star Trek universe. And so now they've got their rings, but they're losing power. So that makes a lot of sense to me as a reader of this.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. So this one seems to be a lot more focused, I think, on the core than on the Star Trek side of things, at least compared to the first series of books, as far as I remember. So this is me basically just learning about these guys again. So I'm curious to see where the series goes. Again, lots of setup, not a lot of kind of revelation of what's going on yet. So kind of holding off to see where this story goes.
And I've said it before, and you'll hear me say it again, I'm not really that big into crossovers with other franchises. But, you know, looking at this as a crossover with Green Lantern, and what, you know, I do know of Green Lantern, this is a good introduction to a story. I'm actually interested to see what happens in this. I find it interesting that they have lost powers and that they're helping Starfleet. And by the way, this takes place in the Kelvin universe. So we're seeing the Kelvin universe Enterprise through this. So it feels very modern. It feels very much like a mix of what we've seen in the movies and the previous comics blended in with a DC comic. So it's kind of cool in a lot of ways to see how Jordan and a lot of these other Green Lantern characters throughout this issue.
Yeah, definitely. I'm eager for when you get a chance to read the first series, because I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. Because speaking as someone who, again, doesn't know anything about Green Lantern, I really enjoyed that story. So curious to see what you think about that.
Yeah, that one's coming out, like I said, in April. So I'm going to be reading that halfway through this series.
Perfect. Well, we do have another comic that just came out. This one is the Next Boldly Go comic, issue number 4, wrapping up the current arc that's going on in that series. So before we get to my thoughts on this one, Bruce, what did you think of this?
Well, I love the way you laughed. I think that's a bit telling. I'm a little mixed on it. Just seeing Spock as Locutus, in a sense, not that he is Locutus, but he's getting Borgified in this issue, or assimilated, of course. But there's some issues with assimilating Spock because he's half human, half Vulcan, and it kind of makes sense that the Borg are trying to adapt him based on his logical side, but he can counterbalance that with his emotions. And it seems that in a way it conf- confuses the Borg as they're assimilating him. They just don't know how to get to into his mind to assimilate him in the right way, that he's able to then go from logic to emotion to kind of break the link and bust out from the Borg assimilating him. Did I get that right?
I think that's what they're kind of trying to put across. I'm going to be blunt. I don't buy it. I think I think Spock's ability to resist being assimilated and just, I don't know. I think it was, to me personally, just kind of a bit of a cheap out to get around him being assimilated. I don't know. I have to admit, I did not enjoy this one. I thought it wrapped things up just a little too conveniently, a little too quickly. You know, the Borg, they've already been so watered down by this point in the Star Trek universe that this just makes them totally impotent by the end here. And I don't know, it's frustrating.
It did feel too easy, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It just feels like everything falls apart for them, and I guess they can defeat the Borg now. I just, man.
I think this would work better if they continued building the story for a few more issues, where the Borg are harder to defeat than just show up and defeat them in one issue. Mm-hmm. And then maybe I'd like to see more about the Borg trying to find the Narada and deal with the Romulans and just try to figure out what the Borg is, what they're, see the Borg trying to accomplish something than just showing up and attacking and then being blown up. But
yeah, yeah, exactly.
But it's hinted at that, you know, the Borg may return. So I'm hoping we get something like this is just kind of like a piece to a larger story that's going to come later.
Maybe. I don't know. I wouldn't be too sad if they never showed up in the Kelvin timeline again. But I mean, I guess they're there and the Borg are aware of them. So like Picard says at the end of Q-Who, they'll be coming.
That's true, number one. I think the thing I would really like to get out of this is there's something about the Narada that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Borg is searching for it. It's not just that the Narada was built with some Borg technology, but maybe there's a secret technology involved that they are looking to protect, or there's just something in there that they're really determined to find and that we're not aware of and Starfleet's not aware of. And so I'm just looking for some a surprise element and go, aha, had no idea that the Narada had that. No wonder the Borg is after them. Like, that's the kind of thing I hope we get from future stories.
That makes sense. And I think that's sort of the thing that I was waiting for the whole time. And then with them just kind of blowing them up, it just kind of fizzled out for me. So, yeah, from your mouth to IDW's ears, like, I'd be on board if there was a deeper layer to it like that, for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, there's more issues coming, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Absolutely. Well, we also got a sneak preview of the cover for Boldly Go number 5. Now, this one, just based on the cover, I'm excited about. I was a huge fan of Jayla in Beyond. And this cover looks really cool. I really love Jayla's look here.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this because when it comes to movies, I like to see characters introduced in the movies continue on in printed form. And so it's great that Jayla is not just a thing in Beyond and that's the last we see of her, that we're actually going to develop her character and integrate her with the crew in some manner in these comics. And maybe it's her, we see her going off to Starfleet Academy, or maybe she's visiting the crew for whatever reason. I don't know. I don't know what the story is about, but to have her on the cover is very promising.
And finally, one last little bit of news that I just stumbled across today. Last year, of course, we had Star Trek as a whole, its 50th anniversary. But this month, January 2016, actually marks Treklet's 50th anniversary because James Blish's Star Trek number one first came out in January of 1967, apparently. So how cool is that? 50 years of Star Trek books.
Wow, I didn't even realize that. That is so cool.
Yeah, I just I stumbled across that. I should give credit to the user who pointed me to that, but I don't remember. It was on the Trek BBS. And yeah, somebody pointed out that it was 50 years ago this month that we got our first Star Trek print.
That is awesome. And so I have to admit, when the 25th anniversary came out, they came out with a reprint of the James Blish stories in 3-volume paperback set. And I debated back and forth if I was going to get those or not. Should I? Shouldn't I? Because I was kind of like, well, there's so much Star Trek to read. I already know those stories from the episodes, but it would be kind of cool to have them. And I didn't get them, and I always regretted it. And now for the 50th anniversary, there was a volume of all the stories at Barnes & Noble, one big hardcover. And I bought that. And I've already started reading some of it. So that's pretty cool that it's been 50 years.
Yeah, definitely pretty cool. Okay, so I did quickly find it on the Trek BBS. Somebody with the very catchy name of Ryan123450 actually pointed that out on the Trek BBS. And so that's pretty cool. I do remember those 25th anniversary volumes, and I think that might have been some of the first Star Trek in print that I actually ever did read, because I remember our local library carried a bunch of them. And I remember that 25th anniversary logo on the front and flipping through and thinking, wait a minute, this is an episode. And then, oh, that's what these books are about. Very cool.
Yeah.
So happy 50th anniversary to Star Trek books.
Yeah. I mean, this is like an anniversary show. This is our 50th. Now that's exciting.
Awesome. Well, what better way to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Star Trek books by listening to past episodes of Literary Treks and subscribing if you haven't already. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, we're of course on iTunes. While you're there, be sure to hit that subscribe button and leave us a star rating and review. This really helps us rise in the search results on iTunes and makes it possible for more Star Trek book fans to find us. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find the shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link there as well. If you'd like to get into contact with us, we have a form on the website at trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail there as well. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. While you're on Facebook, we also have the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, Bruce, what's another great way that you can connect with Literary Trek specifically?
Well, you can go to Goodreads. And Goodreads is a website where people discuss books. And of course, we have a group in there so we can discuss Star Trek books. So if you go to Goodreads and search for Literary Treks, then you can, I guess, register or whatever. You click to join and we get an email to approve you to get in the group. And in that forum, you can discuss Star Trek books about what we discuss on the show or just any Star Trek book that you're reading and discuss it with other Star Trek book fans.
Awesome. Well, what do you say we get to the feature and start talking about this week's novel?
I'm looking very forward to it.
Well, this week we've got a brand new TOS novel to talk about, Christopher L. Bennett's The Face of the Unknown, the January novel for 2017, kicking off the new year in Star Trek literature. Now, I love the original series. And I have to say, the Corbomite Maneuver is one of my absolute favorite episodes. It's kind of, I can't remember what order I saw the episodes in, but I do remember a very early moment in my life watching this episode and just being transfixed by the Baylock puppet and, you know, trying to figure out this weird alien threat. And then, of course, the big surprise at the end that, you know, this is a small diminutive alien who is just testing us and we're going to be friends with them now. You know, a very Star Trek story. And it's really cool that we get a sequel to that story in this one.
And it's very odd to me that we've never had a sequel. And as we were talking about, 50 years of Star Trek book publishing, and we've never had a sequel to this episode. And it just amazes me that with all the books out there, that there's still so much to mine. And And this is great. Now, this episode of the Corbinite Maneuver was never like a big favorite of mine. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid, I remember my dad watching it, and I thought, okay, that's really weird because that little kid sounds like a man, and that's kind of freaky. And at the end credits, I'd always see that puppet, and I always thought, that guy's kind of scary. And then I found out later he was really a puppet, and I'm like, what is this show? I'm going back to watch $6 Million Man. But now, of course, I love it. And so it's very surprising that we've never had a sequel to that episode. And I was pumped to read this book because of that.
Absolutely, yeah. I know they've gotten like a few name drops here and there in, you know, Trek literature. Never ever mentioned again, as far as I know, in like canon Star Trek. I don't think they've ever even been name dropped or anything in Deep Space Nine or TNG or anything like that. But reading the acknowledgments to this book, it's interesting that Christopher Bennett says that he always wanted to write the definitive book about the First Federation. And I think that's definitely something he's really accomplished here. This was a really cool look into that civilization and what they're all about. I do remember as a kid hearing the name First Federation and like, well, what does that mean? Was there like a United Federation of Planets before ours, or like, what was that about? And that we finally get some of those answers here and finally get to understand a little bit more about that culture was really exciting.
And I remember reading Christopher Bennett mentioning on his blog that the First Federation was briefly dealt with in the mirror universe of the Shatnerverse books.
Oh.
And also that it was in the Next Generation novel, Gulliver's Fugitives, which was the very first Next Generation novel I ever read. But that was such a long time ago, I don't even remember. But again, I don't think they were like huge I don't think they were a huge focus. The First Federation was a huge focus in those books. So this is truly, as Chris wants to do, make this the definitive book for the First Federation.
Mm-hmm. So kind of the first big surprise we get in this book is, you understand from the Corbomite maneuver that the Baylock puppet is just that, a puppet that's designed to look scary and intimidating, but doesn't actually represent a real person. It's just there to frighten the crew of the Enterprise. But in this novel, we learn that they are actually based on an actual race of beings called the Dasik or the Dasik. I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
Yeah, I was thinking Dasik, but...
Dasik. Okay, we'll go with that. This was a race of hunters that once conquered the entire galaxy, it almost sounds like. But then, for reasons that are kind of unknown at the beginning of the novel anyway, they disappeared from the galactic stage and kind of survive as cautionary fairy tales for Baylock's people, the Linnik. But by the end of the novel, of course, we learn a lot more about the complicated relationship between them. That aspect of the story, what did you kind of think of how that played out?
I really like this because when you watch that episode, you think of the puppet as just being that. It's a made-up figure. And maybe some people thought it was based on a real race, but I never really did.
Mm-hmm.
And so to find out that they've almost become a myth to Baylock's people, stories that, like you mentioned, they tell their children, and they're fearful stories. The boogeymen of, their species. But it's based on this real race that had once enslaved them years and years ago and using Baylock's people for their intelligence. But because physically they aren't as big as the Dasik, that they were able to turn the tables on the Dasik and basically I don't want to get too far into it yet, but they conquered them and left. And like you said, the Daesic were kind of gone for long periods of time. So I was very encouraged by the fact, like, this scary looking puppet that I used to see at the end credits was actually a real race, and that we're actually going to see them in this book. And as a kid, I used to think they were scary, and to find out they were fake, and now that they're real, I'm like, yes, this is awesome. I just thought this was like in my mind, as these characters are being portrayed in the book, I kept trying to picture them actually looking more physically real, that their mouths actually mm-hmm. move correctly in their eyes, and that they're not so mechanical. And I saw them as being, you know, very kind of tall and dominating. And I just tried to picture their voices being real deep. And I mean, it was just like so cool. They came to life is what I'm getting at. They came to life for me. And after all these years, it's so nice to see that vision of an alien scary creature come to life.
Definitely. I had very much the same experience, you know, trying to picture exactly how they would move and how they would talk. And I kept putting in Baylock's fake voice for them, especially with the war leader or the force leader speaking. It's like, "We will rain upon them their doom." I was like, yes, this is awesome.
You know, if you ever reread the book, give them a different voice, maybe a really high pitched voice. Maybe they talk like this, like Mickey Mouse, and, you know, whatever. That would actually be funny.
Absolutely. One thing you could definitely tell was I think Christopher Bennett had a lot of fun writing a lot of their dialogue in particular. And I picture him thinking of that Baylock voice as well, because so many of those phrases that they say and kind of over the top villainy on the part of a few of them anyway, it was really, really entertaining to read for sure. And similarly, I have to say, picturing Baylock walking around and talking to and laughing every third sentence, you had to put in that from the end of the episode, because, oh man, Baylock was just such a funny character. And to imagine him interacting with the crew like he does in this book again was a lot of fun.
And he was always obsessed with drinking his, was it Tranya?
Tranya,
yeah. He was always like, then if everything blows up, we won't have Tranya to drink. It's like, oh, come on. You're like, you're a Tranya-holic, you know?
I think so. I think, yeah, there's definitely that aspect to him. I always think of him every time he took a sip of it in the Corbomite maneuver, that very, you know, I love this guy. I think I'd love to be friends with him. He might get a little annoying at times, but I think he's awesome.
Well, if you watch the Roddenberry Vault on Blu-ray, Clint Howard, who played that character, is on there and says that, you know, he was actually learned the lines and spoke them, and learned out later they were dubbing him with an adult. So he was a little disappointed with that. But and let me ask you this. Have you recently watched the episode while you were reading this book, or right before or after?
Oh man, I didn't really get a chance to. I have seen it fairly recently, I think a couple months ago, but yeah, I would have liked the chance to read or to watch it right as I was reading this book for sure.
Yeah, I watched it maybe a third of the way into the book, and
oh nice.
I mean, I just like the fact that my perception of the episode changes a little, because I know more of the background, but I haven't watched it since I've finished the whole book, so it should be interesting to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll definitely put that on my list of things to do for sure. So another aspect of this book that was, I think, fairly apparent is there's a very clear environmental message here. We've got this planet, Chirrella, which is this gas giant, and hidden beneath the clouds of this world is the Web of Worlds, which is basically the entirety of the First Federation. You know, tons of modules of different habitats for all these different species and different biospheres that support the entire population. And because of the huge size of the planet, you know, this one world is able to host the populations of, you know, what would be the equivalent of hundreds of M-class planets. And it was really interesting. You know, Christopher Bennett's really good at world building. And I think he put a lot of thought and effort into this world in particular and the threat that it faces. So it uses this complicated technology to hide it from the outside universe, which puts it kind of out of balance with the natural environment around it in the gas giant, which is causing, you know, extra large storms and various things like that that threaten the habitat. Now, the government doesn't really believe that it's a problem. They're kind of in the dark a little bit as to the extent of the danger that they're facing.
What? I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, this is totally new. Like, this is an unprecedented situation that, frankly, I've never encountered before.
Well, yeah, it definitely jumped out to me as, hey, this is climate change or global warming. And some people say they believe it. Some people say they don't. And, you know, and that's what Star Trek does. It takes an issue like that and puts it in a different setting and shows, you know, what could possibly happen in our own world if we don't believe in something that scientists say is true. And, you know, politics are involved and studies can be altered. So a lot of people question, especially when government talks, whether something is really true or not, whether, yeah, is the scientific research being presented correctly? And that's kind of what's going on here.
Well, it's just a natural fluctuation, of course, and everything will kind of work itself out. I mean, you know, the things they're doing to the environment, they can't possibly have that big an effect on a system that big. So, no, it'll all work out. It'll be fine.
Well, and of course we find out it doesn't all work out. But, you know, I mean, this is, of course, yeah, we're going to get a little political here, but this is, of course, the author's views in a lot of ways on global warming and that we should listen to the call and what science is saying, and that it's not maybe just a natural thing. It's man-made or caused by man. And maybe it is and maybe it's not. I mean, everybody can have that debate. But in this story, we're finding out that it is caused by these races of beings, because as you're saying, Dan, in explaining this, that they're trying to hide on this planet. And this is like a gas planet. This is something larger than Jupiter. And I think it was like 4 or 5 times bigger and can host all of these different races in these worlds that could be about the size of like half of the United Federation of Planets, which is mind-boggling in itself to even think. I had to get my head around that for a while. But mm-hmm. but it's really cool to think about that. But they're using that atmosphere to hide themselves so that Dasik or any other race doesn't find them. They're trying to be protected. But after hundreds and thousands of years of just, and that's what I'm saying, it was a long period of time of them just kind of taking this atmosphere and manipulating it and creating energy. And then the energy creates heat. And then they have to create another kind of energy to calm down that heat and so on and so forth, that at some point something's going to break. And so things start to get a little more violent. But then the government doesn't want to stop it because then they'll be exposed. And so to avoid that, they tell people, well, you know, this is natural. It's all going to work out. It's all going to be fine. And if that were true, this wouldn't be much of a story. So, of course, it's not all going to be fine. And so that's where our story goes to some destruction that starts to occur.
And like any great Star Trek story, you know, things come to a head just when our heroes happen to arrive on the scene.
Yes, and just like any good story, Kirk tries to help them out, and things don't always go well, and then they blame it on him.
Exactly.
It's yeah. His fault. We could have survived this if it wasn't the Enterprise and Kirk getting involved.
So yeah, of course, with the story, like you say, Kirk becomes the scapegoat in this, when in fact, in true Starfleet tradition, all we were trying to do was help, you know. All these aliens don't understand, we're just trying to help. But I really liked that idea, because a lot of times when people are in a situation and they're surrounded by it, you can kind of become blind to what's happening around you. And it really sometimes takes that outsider's perspective to really take a look at things and realize what's happening. So Spock, for example, examines the calculations of these dissidents who have, you know, employed these scientists to figure out what's going on. And he looks it over and says, no, this is real. Like, this is actually happening. But unfortunately, the member of the First Federation who he's become quite close to, whose name I can't remember at the moment.
Nisu,
right. Nisu, unfortunately, is just far too close to the situation. And so she believes that it's Spock's emotions that are ruling him. Now, we know Spock, and we know that that's not the case. And in fact, it's the emotions of this Nisu person who is really guiding her actions and not letting her see what's actually happening. And I thought that was a really interesting tack for the story to take. Just the idea that Spock would be blind because of his love of his captain and wanting to exonerate him, that he would throw in with these rebels to spout these lies. And I think it's just perfect that the character of Spock is used that way, because, as we all know, he wouldn't be influenced that way.
No, because, he's not going to make decisions based on emotions, at least in this particular case.
True.
But, and that's what's interesting about Nisu. She's chief protector of the planet, almost like a security chief of the First Federation. And to accuse him of believing in something because she thinks it may be an emotional response or whatever, I mean, that, again, that's very similar to our own society in this world today. I mean, a lot of people do make decisions on emotion, whether the reaction should be true or not to what the facts are. And again, facts can be manipulated into any way people want, and people will believe or not believe those facts based on emotion or other beliefs. So, you know, I'm just kind of rambling on about it, but, you know, it's these things in this book that make me think about what we're going through now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's always good to kind of take that time to self-reflect a little bit and try and figure out if your immediate gut reaction to something is based on kind of a logical thinking through of things, or is it based on emotion? And I mean, that's very true for all sides of any debate, really. And like you say, your beliefs really will dictate where you go in that. And it's interesting you bring up, we talked a little bit about emotions driving situations. We've got another interesting situation brewing in the web of worlds that feels very familiar in a lot of ways to a lot of things that we see every day in today's world. And that's the idea of fear and overriding fear dictating our actions and dictating what we believe, basically. So the government is afraid of what's outside of the world, and like we've said, they refuse to believe the findings of these scientists. They hear what they want to hear. And instead of overcoming that fear or utilizing it to a greater end, they instead intensify it. They stoke that fear to create more fear and more paranoia to distract from the real problem. And that's something that has been repeated many times in our own history, is this idea of creating a fearful population and stoking it because fearful people are more easily manipulated. And we definitely see that play out a bit in this novel.
The name of the novel is The Face of the Unknown, and that comes from the Corbinite Maneuver episode. That's a line in there. But in a lot of ways, the book could be renamed The Fear of the Unknown, because I feel like this book is really just about that, is fear. And on so many different levels throughout the story, do we examine fear. And just like you were talking about, the government is putting fear in the people, and the people fear what could happen to them because of the disaster that's going on with these lightning storms on their planet. And the Dasik, they were conquered by the Lennox people years ago by giving the Lennox used a bioweapon against them and gave them a mutation that they actually shrunk and became weaker, and they've kind of overcome, and they couldn't live much beyond their years. It was like, you know, like 8 years or something, like an Ocampa or something. I don't know. But anyway, they couldn't live very long. But they've kind of, some of them could mature to, you know, into a maturity or whatever. But their people are dying because of this mutation that happened years ago. So the Nasik are looking for the Linux, look to see what was done to them so that they could conquer the problem of the mutation so they can live on in their lives. But once some of these Desik get to the planet, there's a fear of the Linux and the First Federation trying to conquer them again. So again, they react out of fear, not trying to reach out after generations and generations and generations. The generations of these people did this to each other. They're, you know, it's their great, 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 great grandfathers. And now, you know, why not reach out and talk to one another and see if one will support the other through all these generations? But instead, fear comes up again. And what I really liked a lot was Baylock and Bailey, Lieutenant Bailey from that episode. And that he brought Bailey on because Bailey was fearful and he made reactions based on fear. And Baylock wanted to see, could Riley conquer his fear and live beyond that and turn fear into a negative, from a negative to a positive? And he was able to do that. And Bailey started to learn to use less fear, but be more constructive with it. And because of that, Baylock said he learned from Bailey and is trying to teach that now to his own people.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. The problem at the root of all of this, whether it's the environmental problem or the problem with the Dasik and their genetic mutation, those are very complicated issues. They're very intricate and layered. And the thing about people who are afraid is, you know, when you're at that level of fear and being controlled by it, you can't really deal with complicated problems. You want very simple, clear objectives and goals. So, for example, like, that's why Hitler was able to take power in Germany to rally the people around a scapegoat. That he had a very clear answer. It's all of these people's fault and we should hate them. They're the reason for all our problems. And I love this. There's this back and forth between Baylock and another member of the triumvirate in the First Federation. And he says to Baylock, "It doesn't matter if it makes sense, Commander. It's what the people need to hear. Frightened people need clear, simple reassurances, not complicated truths." Baylock looked him over with contempt, "which is no doubt why you're so eager to make the people afraid. It makes them so much easier to control, especially when you don't have the truth on your side." And I love that because it's so true. You know, you can't really deal with these complicated issues if all you're doing is running around completely terrified. And you brought up Bailey, and I absolutely love that because I'm a huge fan of character arcs, and I think Bailey has this beautiful arc. And in the Corbomite maneuver, we see the beginnings of where he's going and how he's going to change. But of course, at the end of the episode, the Enterprise flies off and we never hear from him again. But here we really see how that experience has changed him. And then what I absolutely love and I thought was brilliant was we get Bailey's mirror in, I want to call him Koost, this member of the Dasik who starts out very fearful. He's captured by the First Federation. He shares a cell with Kirk at one point and tries to kill him, but he gets talked down and faces his fears rather than letting them control him. And at the end, he's named as a delegate to the First Federation. And I see his path taking much the same as Bailey's. He would never admit it. In fact, several times in the book, he says, "I fear nothing." But he and his entire people have been governed by fear this whole time. And this is the turning point for them and bringing these two people together to overcome that fear. And I just thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, that's a great point there, the parallel of those two characters. I hadn't thought about it that way, but that's definitely true. And, you know, fear is sometimes fear prevents me from doing things and I try to overcome that fear. Like, hey, why don't you try podcasting? Oh, I don't know if I can do that. Still don't know if I can do it. No, I'm just kidding. But it's, you know, but you know, you have to just overcome those fears and take chances. But then fear is also a good thing. It makes you sometimes not do things that you shouldn't do. You know, it's like, you know, you're not, I'm not going to jump off the house because oh, I have no fear anymore. And then I kill myself. But as I was reading this and thinking about fear and how that reflects on me and my daily life, and I want to overcome some fears so I can accomplish more things, I thought, well, you know, I have to have fear. And all of a sudden I went to Kirk in Star Trek V when he's talking about pain. You know, I need my pain, you know, and I need my fear. Mm-hmm. And as much as I want to overcome fear, I need it. So I really liked, again, how the book made me think about something even beyond the page and just thinking about fear in general and how it relates to my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, fear does definitely have its place. I mean, it's an evolutionary thing that is very important. I mean, you can't just run blindly into the tall grass because you're going to get killed by that big snake there. So, you know, fear is definitely a good thing, but it's never a good thing to let it completely rule your life, as I think a lot of the characters in this book and in my day-to-day life that I see and at points in my own life, I think has happened. And, yeah, no, it's definitely something that should be mediated. And I think Christopher Bennett does a really good job of getting that point across here. Kind of speaking of emotions in general, I think we alluded to it earlier, but there's a really interesting through line in this story concerning Spock. So this book takes place at a very specific point in Star Trek history. It's kind of in between the original series and going into the animated series. And one thing that I found really interesting that I never really thought of before was the third season of Star Trek has a lot of failings and a lot of interesting roads that it took. And one of them is in the character of Spock. You know, he had a lot of experiences in the third season that were a little out of character, and I never really gave it much thought other than, well, it's the third season and, you know, things kind of went off the rails a little bit. But another thing that I think Bennett does just brilliantly here is explain some of that. So in the Cloudminders, for example, he's outright flirting with Droxine, and we're not given any indication in that episode that it's anything other than the fact that she's kind of hot. And you know, I love that Bennett has Spock kind of reflecting on that in this and saying, like, what's going on? Like, something's going on with me. And he comes to some really interesting conclusions about specifically what happened to him in Amok Time and getting spurned by T'Pring and feeling that he doesn't have something that's very important to Vulcans. He doesn't really have that to contribute to his society, and that's, you know, becoming a husband and creating children. And
right, because that's really his fear. His fear is not having that legacy.
Yeah, exactly. And it ties in really nicely to that. Absolutely. And I thought that was just a really interesting place to take this story and this character.
Well, and not only does that help to explain some of the odd behavior that we might attribute to Spock in that third season, but it also shows that he's trying to evaluate what is his ultimate goal. Where is he trying to go? I mean, does he even have a career in Starfleet? You know, what is his next thing? What is his future? Which, of course, leads us to the events that precede the motion picture. So it is a kind of a great bridge between the third season and the motion picture and the animated series, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So I really like that. And again, that's the great thing about these novels is like, you know, it can change your perception and look at these episodes and these movies in a totally different way. And I just love, you know, it's not there to fix mistakes, but it does, you know, mm-hmm. and it just enhances absolutely. Stuff. It's really great. I love that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of something that Christopher Bennett's really been known to do is to take things that were considered like continuity errors or mistakes and really fixing them. I mean, his Department of Temporal Investigations, that first novel, was basically about rectifying all the inconsistencies in time travel. And I never really thought of this as an area that needed that. But after having read this book, I'm like, oh man, that makes that all make sense. Kind of those parts of Spock's character in season 3 that you just kind of go la 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 over. Oh, now they actually fit in this cohesive whole. And I love that. I thought that was great.
Well, and the other thing I read in Bennett's blog is that his original intent was to build the story after the motion picture in the movie time frame, the movie era. But the editor suggested it take place during the original 5-year mission because we're in the 50th anniversary of that show. And I think, of course, having not seen what this would have turned out in the movie area, but I think this works better in this 5-year mission because these events that take place after the Corbinite maneuver are just within about 3 years after those events. And it just feels right that it be closer to that episode, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it gives us this opportunity to do what Bennett did with Spock. So I think this is really the right time frame for this story.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I generally enjoy movie era stories a little bit more just because it's something a little bit different. But I do definitely appreciate the editor's reasoning for putting it here. I mean, you know, the 50th anniversary, I guess, you know, the 5-year mission is what the average person would think of when they think of Star Trek. So that kind of makes sense. And like you say, it does give this opportunity for this really kind of unique point in Spock's life and to do something really different with it and really cast that whole era in a different light, which I thought was really cool. And other things like about this particular moment in Star Trek history, you know, there's a lot of really interesting little tie-ins that Bennett is able to make with this, you know, kind of end of the, and not end of the 5-year mission, end of the Star Trek television series and beginning of the animated series. You know, Chekhov is about to move on. Of course, he wasn't in the animated series. He was replaced at navigation by Eriks. And we get that kind of, maybe not as much of it as I would have liked, actually, but we get a little bit of Chekhov kind of thinking about, you know, what he wants to accomplish in his life and his idea to kind of move on a little bit. And then little continuity touches that I thought were really cool, like Anne Norred from the animated series. She was in the episode The Survivor, I believe. Yep. Excellent. I got my fact checker here. You know, and just little things like that, and name dropping Carter Winston as her her missing fiance or husband, I'm not sure, but it's really cool to bring in these parts of Trek continuity that are usually kind of ignored by the wider Trek universe.
Yeah, and I remember there was a brief, very brief mention about there being like a second lift on the bridge. It was right. Like, it like went by me at first. So I was like, wait, did I just read that? Oh yeah. He does say, you know, there's a second entryway or something to that effect, which meant me went, okay, that's probably the other lift. Okay. That's cool. So yeah, I was seeing how the animated series was kind of brought in and, you know, Eriks was going to join the team after Chekhov leaves. And that's a nod to the latter fire that came out earlier in the year, because we saw that transition take place there. So yeah, those little connections are just fun. If you follow all the Star Trek lore that's out there.
I was waiting for it as I was finishing just the last few pages of the book just today. And, I'm not sure if I'm thankful that he didn't do it or wish that he did, but I was waiting for Kirk to look around the bridge and comment that, like, everybody seems a little bit more animated today or something like that. I think I'm glad he didn't do that. But if I were writing this novel, the temptation would have been so great.
Oh, my gosh. That's something I would say. I can't believe you went there. Exactly.
This is why I don't write Star Trek novels. They just throw that right out.
Or maybe say Kirk's like, you know, well, you know, I have to get up early tomorrow. Saturday mornings just aren't going to be the same for a while.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Should have Aaron Harvey on to talk about this one.
We should read the logs from the animated series. You know what? There's just, okay, everybody, listeners, I'm just going to let you know. Now that Dan and I are doing the show, we're like, oh, well, what do we read next? And the list is just getting longer and longer and longer. Oh, we want to do this. Let's read this. I mean, we're open to everything.
We're going to be reading books right up to the Vulcans land in 2063. Like, I mean, we've got so much on the plate here. But yeah, so this novel in particular, The Face of the Unknown, if you were going to give your final thoughts and what you would rate this one, what would you say?
Well, I enjoyed this probably more than I thought I would. I was excited to read the book, but I don't really know what... I don't think I really had any high expectations, but it really was a very good read. No pun intended to Goodreads website. So I would say that I would give this 4.5 out of 5 lightning strikes.
Ooh, and those are like continent-sized lightning strikes. So that's pretty
huge. They can disrupt a whole world.
Wow. Yeah, I'm kind of with you on this. I don't think I wasn't expecting to enjoy it, but I don't think I was particularly excited about this book. But reading it, it was a lot of fun and a lot of really interesting things to say. And it really reminded me how much I loved the Corbomite Maneuver and Baylock and the Fisarius and all of that stuff from that episode. So I had a really good time reading this book, and with it tying into the third season in ways that I hadn't thought of, I thought that was just kind of icing on the cake. I'm a continuity buff. I love that continuity stuff. So that was all really great. And I think I would have to give this one probably 4 bowls of Tranya.
Let's drink up.
Oh, man. I need to get that sound effect and put it there. I should have prepared that.
You've been practicing that laugh, haven't you?
Oh, man. It went through my head every single time Baylock laughed in this novel.
Well, I really enjoyed talking about that book, and reading it was great too. It just really enhances the Corbinite Maneuver episode for me. And like I said, as a kid, that episode, I saw that, I was like, what the heck? I have no interest. And now I'm into the episode and into the book. It's just exciting. And I love it.
Did you have like the Corbomite Maneuver music going through? Bum, 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 bum.
Actually, I did. And it, when I heard it in my head, it was you doing what you just did.
Ah, oh, great. I almost had another bell.
It's like, I can hear Dan doing the music. See, we're getting you close to singing for us. We're getting there.
I mean, that was pretty close.
your wamba was just a little too sharp, but everything else was perfect.
It's kind of pitchy, kind of pitchy. Well, if you want to continue to hear me almost sing, or maybe you don't and want to make that clear,
just write in and complain. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can absolutely do that. But one way you can get Literary Treks coming to you and all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Ken Tripp, Brandon Shea Matula, and Norman Lau for their support of the network and for being associate producers for Literary Treks as well. Well, Bruce, when you're not creating a terrifying Mr. Hyde doppelganger puppet of yourself to sit across from me and scare me while we do these podcasts, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Admiral_Rex. And you can also find me in our Babel conference talking about Star Trek and occasionally on the 602 Club with Matthew Rushing. I'm on there every once in a while talking about Star Wars or some other things. And we have like Supergirl coming up. I'll be probably on there talking about that. And also, I do like to talk Star Wars on the podcast called The Star Wars Report. So check that out. And Dan, when you're not looking around at other people and wondering why they're animated, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. You can find me on YouTube. I've got a channel on there at youtube.com/Kertrats Productions. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Kertrats Productions. And of course, kicking around the Babel Conference, posting about all things Star Trek. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And until next time,
live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.